Welcome back to the Equipping You in Grace podcast. With me today is Jared C. Wilson. Jared, thanks for coming on the Equipping You in Grace podcast today. It's great to be able to chat with you. Can you tell us a little bit about your life, marriage, ministry, and some of the current ministry projects you're working on, please?
Sure. Right now, I'm currently employed by Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary in Kansas City, Missouri. I serve as their director of content strategy. So I oversee things like social media and content that goes out promotionally for the seminary advertising, that sort of thing. But mainly, my main role here is I serve as managing editor for a website called For the Church, FTC.co, FTC.co. I'm the main editor for that, puts out gospel-centered resources every day, blog posts, videos, that sort of thing, aimed at ministry leaders. Before I came to Kansas City, a little over a year ago, my last ministry position was with a church in Vermont, in rural Vermont. I was served there for about 6 years before coming here. I'm married to Becky. We've been married, it'll be 20 years this month, end of this month, June 29th. We are our 20th wedding anniversary, and we have two daughters. One's about to be a teenager. The other one's been a teenager for a little while. We're just enjoying life being here in the Midwest. And ministry projects, aside from the website, always blogging, trying to, you know, help people apply the gospel to their everyday lives, both at For the Church and at the Gospel Coalition. I have a blog at the Gospel Coalition called Gospel Driven Church, and you can find that at gospeldrivenchurch.com. And, of course, I always have different writing projects and that sort of thing going on.
Oh, awesome. Would you please tell us a little bit about your book, Unparalleled, How Christianity's Uniqueness Makes It Compelling, why you wrote it, and how you hope it's received?
Yeah, you know, I think the impetus behind the book, the idea originally was from my time pastoring in Vermont and trying to share the gospel, stay on mission. And Vermont is the least churched state in the nation. It has the highest concentration of people who identify as none in terms of religion, putting down no religion on religious surveys. So it's the most irreligious state in the nation. New England, the six New England states, are always in the top 10 or bottom 10, depending on how you look at it, in terms of religious activity and religious affiliation. And so having grown up in the Bible Belt, being trained in churches for more culturally Christian areas, how to engage the faith. And of course, I grew up with books like Josh McDowell's More Than a Carpenter and Evidence That Demands a Verdict, of course, sort of graduating on to, you know, more classic apologetics work, admirer of Greg Kuchel's and that sort of thing. But a lot of the ways that I was trained for evangelism, sharing the gospel, these sort of more heavily Christian or more religiously, culturally religious areas. And what I found in having these gospel conversations in Vermont, and I think this is going to, you know, is going to become increasingly true in the nation as the entire country becomes more irreligious, at least formally irreligious, is that people had this tendency to go off script. They weren't sort of following the evangelistic template that I thought they would. And they were asking questions and sharing life experiences that I didn't expect them to. And so I just wasn't prepared. And so I had to sort of rethink the way I share the gospel. Not that the gospel changes, the message is still the same, but I needed a more sort of holistic approach, a more narrative approach, a way that to talk about the essential truth claims of Christianity in ways that corresponded not just to the intellect, but also to the heart. And that, to me, sort of brings apologetics more into the realm of the gospel because, you know, no Christian truly believes that someone becomes a Christian because they've had, you know, an intellectual change, simply an intellectual change. You know, certainly that's part of it. It's a renewing of the mind. You know, the message of the gospel is a spiritual thing. It's a supernatural thing. You are born again when you are converted. And so I think what I've tried to do in Unparalleled is not just help Christians answer intellectual objections, but actually help them see how the truth claims of Christianity correspond to desires in the human heart, how actually only Christianity is situated to correspond to the human appetite for things like community and for belonging and a sense of justice and all of that sort of thing.
What led you to want to take a gospel-centered approach to apologetics?
Yeah, I think it's because I wanted to put the emphasis on the gospel. I mean, a lot of times in the way we're trained for apologetics or the way we think about apologetics is that if we just had the right answers to the intellectual arguments, somebody would be convinced, sort of convinced into the faith. And so you see these sort of evangelistic techniques that are really about rhetoric and kind of, you know, cornering people philosophically, get them to admit they're sinners, and then you present the message of the gospel and so on and so forth. So I would say to have a gospel-centered approach, really the lead up is different. You're not obscuring the gospel, you're not removing the gospel, but the context that you put the gospel in when it comes to a gospel-centered approach to apologetics is the answering the skeptic, the well-reasoned answers to the objections support the message of the gospel rather than become the dominant, point of conversation. So the gospel isn't some sort of add-on to a kind of philosophical debate. And we are, I think, the grace-driven approach emphasizes really the sort of relational connection and even the grand storyline of all of Scripture, the big storyline of humans and, the redemption that is to be had through Jesus Christ, more so than sort of point-by-point logic and philosophical objections. I think it just sort of, it doesn't downplay or doesn't, disregard those things. It just sort of downplays them or puts them in a lesser emphasis than, this more relational connection. And I think a heavier emphasis where the power is, which is in the gospel itself. Only the gospel is actual power to save somebody.
So you're talking to somebody and you're taking a gospel centered approach to apologetics with them. What would that conversation look like?
Well, I think it looks a lot like some of the relational connections that Jesus makes, in the gospels. What you see, Jesus is debating or having these sort of philosophical, logical, theological, exchanges where, there's the appeal to logic and that sort of thing. You see that mostly with him, with the religious leaders. So it's with people who have like a theological education. There's some cultural religiosity going on there where there's a bit of common ground. They're not believers, of course, but there's some sort of shared agreement on the basis of the faith, the scriptures, for instance. So they have a shared heritage there. But then when he's having exchanges with people like the Samaritan woman at the well and that sort of thing, he's not avoiding the things you have to discuss when you discuss the gospel, sin and grace, the living water that comes from Christ. So he's not ignoring that. He's not obscuring the gospel, but he comes at it in an entirely different way. There's a more relational context there. And so, I think, the emphasis that I make in Unparalleled is to show how Christianity isn't just unique intellectually, that it doesn't just correspond to, what goes on in our head, but also what goes on in our heart. And this is something that I see Jesus doing over and over again in meeting the needs, not just the intellectual needs, but the physical and the emotional needs. And so when you're having a conversation with somebody about the gospel, especially if it's someone who has no Christian background, really, they're not reading up on all of the philosophical objections to Christianity. So they're not sort of a heated up atheist or anything like that. They're just sort of, yeah, that's nice. They're just kind of a basic moralist, which is kind of the default, place for all humans. Christianity is very well suited, actually, to speak to the fears that they have about their children, to speak to the worries they have about their future, all of that sort of thing. And so I think that's sort of why I take the approach I do in Unparalleled.
How is our obvious need for community uniquely answered with Christian doctrine?
Yeah, the way that the book is structured chapter by chapter is almost like a systematic theology in terms of structure. The text, of course, it's not a systematic theology text, but I've gone chapter by chapter. The progression is to begin with the nature of God, as most systematic theologies do, to talk about the character and quality of God, to go through an anthropology, the Christianity's view on humanity, then to talk about Jesus Christ, then we talk about the practical outworkings of these things, and then, of course, the end times. But when I begin to talk about the nature of God in Unparalleled, I want to talk about how actually helpful, practical, if we can use that word, the doctrine of God is. And the Christian view of God, of course, is that he is Trinity, that the one true God is one God who exists in three persons, simultaneously, co-eternally, same essence, but distinct in person, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And, I grew up believing this, grew up affirming this, grew up in churches that taught faithfully the doctrine of the Trinity, never, as far as I can remember, doubted the reality of the Trinity, but never saw how it could be helpful or correspond to anything, you know, in the human condition or anything like that. What's really wonderful about the doctrine of the Trinity is if we believe that man is made in God's image, male and female, he created them in his image, then it stands to reason that there's got to be some sort of Trinitarian connection there. Not that we are Trinities ourselves, and certainly not that we're gods ourselves, but the Trinity, I think, explains why all of us long for relationships so much, to be fully known and to fully know, to be in community, to have a sense of belonging. I think even introverts like myself, you know, we don't want to be alone. You know, we deal profoundly with a sense of loneliness, and I think that's sort of a common human problem, the sense of loneliness. And the Trinity explains this because God himself has in his very nature community. The Father, Son, and Holy Spirit are in relationship and always have been, you know, forever and ever, eternity, ages past. And so this answers why we have this longing. It's not just a sense of a need for society because it's great for, you know, evolutionary success or anything like that. It's a deep part of our heart to be known and to know and to experience love. And really the reality of the Trinity is sort of the missing equation. It's sort of like the thing Einstein was arguing, the unified field theory, you know, for the human predicament is the doctrine of the Trinity.
What does Unparalleled say is the most important distinguishing factor of Christianity from all others?
Yeah, you know, and I have a chapter in the book that I call the most incredible idea in the history of the universe. And that idea, of course, is the message of the gospel, the message of grace, the idea of grace. You have these sort of aspects of common grace. You have some teaching on forgiveness and mercy in every other religion, but only Christianity has, as part of its doctrine, the idea that we can be justified totally apart from our works by faith alone because of the grace of God. In every other religion and philosophy in the world, religious and irreligious, the system is always contingent on human effort. So whether it's a religious conception of heaven or enlightenment, some sort of spiritual awakening, reconciliation with God, arriving at your place of success or place of vision, whatever it is, everyone is offering steps and commandments and rules and a system to, you know, for humans to work to get there. And certainly there's commandments and rules in Christianity, but only Christianity says it's not by those systems or rules that you get to heaven, that you get saved, that you are reconciled to God, that these things can only come about through the work of Jesus Christ himself. And so we are saved by grace. If you add any works to that at all, it ceases to be grace. And so that's really the singular uniqueness of Christianity. You don't find that anywhere else. To me, it's one of the most compelling things, if not the most compelling thing about Christianity in terms of the Christian teaching, is because I don't think we would have made that up. It doesn't affirm humans enough. It doesn't affirm me enough to for me to have made this up, the idea that I would be saved by no merit of my own. And so through that singular uniqueness, of course, you have Jesus Christ, the Son of God, you know, the incarnation, the crucifixion, the resurrection, the ascension. Jesus Christ himself is really the get of Christianity. It's not, you know, simply a new way of living, but it's actual life that comes through God himself.
Mirrors are always the first thing one thinks of when it comes to religion, but can you describe some mirrors that help reveal the truth of Christianity?
Yeah, you know, there's lots of ways to talk about mirrors. It's such a great metaphor and illustration. In the book, I use the image of a mirror to talk about humanity itself, to talk about us. And so I use the metaphor of a sacred mirror, that we are reflections of God because we're made in his image. And so I think sort of unlocks the way that we struggle with human exceptionality, the way biologists, scientists, secular biologists and scientists can't quite do justice to the exceptionality of humankind. Are we really just sort of advanced in terms of our development from other species? You know, are we just advanced apes sort of thing? You know, that theory may answer some questions, but it tops out. There's a dead end there. It doesn't quite get at what we experience as humans in terms of creativity and consciousness and that sort of thing. And so the mirror, to say that we are reflecting the reality of God, sort of helps get us a little further along. Well, we can tap into the idea of human exceptionality and human potential and creativity and power and all this sort of thing. But then we're going to hit another dead end, and that's the fact that we can't ever get it right. We seem to fail at these, you know, perfection projects. So every time we try to collaborate and create a utopia, it never works. You know, why is there so much injustice in the world? Why, despite all of our advancements, whether you believe we've evolved, you know, physically or not, but, you know, certainly we've evolved technologically. We have medical advancements and cultural advancements that we enjoy now. And yet we still can't seem to quit hating each other and getting into wars with each other and all of this sort of thing. We seem pretty toxic. Well, Christianity, I think, is well suited to answer this because we say, yes, we are sacred mirrors. We reflect the image of God, but we're also broken mirrors. Because of the fall, we can't get the reflection just right. You know, we are really shards of our former self. You know, to take that image into sort of the larger context, C.S. Lewis talked about mythology, all the ways that we struggle to tell the human story from the ancient myths to the modern myths, things in movies and literature and you know, different cultural artifacts. He said all of that is really just sort of like broken glass or, you know, this sort of the ruins of a perfect picture once painted or a perfect story once told that's now just sort of broken. And he said it's sort of like these sort of gleams of light shimmering beneath the surface of the jungle. T.S. Eliot talked about this as well in his poem, The Wasteland, where it's sort of like he's saying that there's got to be a true myth somewhere. There's got to be truth somewhere because we have the sort of shards of that picture, of that painting, of that mirror laying around, and we see little glimpses of beauty, little reflections, glimmers of light here and there. And maybe we can put it all together. Well, Christianity says that God is going to put it all together. He is making all things new. And so one day those who trust in Jesus not only will live in a world where the picture is put back together and restored and better than it ever was before, truly reflecting the glory of God, but we ourselves, those of us who trust in Jesus ourselves, will be put back together, restored, have resurrection bodies that finally perfectly reflect the glory of God.
I know you write a lot, but tell us a bit about what your next writing project is, or if you have more than one.
I do. So I'm working most immediately on one of the sessions for Lifeways, the Gospel Project. I was really privileged to be a part of the very first installment of that curriculum, sort of a gospel-centered Sunday school curriculum is what it is, or Bible study curriculum. I was a part of the team that was on the very first unit of that, coming back to do another unit that will be, I think, for next year. But book project-wise, I have another book coming out with Baker next year in the spring. It's a book on discipleship that we're calling right now. This always, you know, is in danger of changing, but the working title right now is called Crumbs from the Table, subtitled Discipleship for the Rest of Us. And so it's sort of a book on spiritual formation, a book on discipleship for people like me, who have trouble getting their act together.
I look forward to reading that. What books have most helped to shape your ability to write well to the glory of God?
Yeah, you know, it would be really two categories. And in one category all by himself is C.S. Lewis, I read Lewis when I was a kid, and not just the Narnia stories, not just, you know, Space Trilogy, but his nonfiction as well. From junior high on, his apologetics works, his stuff on literature. I really do think he's the greatest Christian writer of the 20th century. And so he is in a lot of ways my master there. And so just sort of, you know, feeding on his work has shaped not just the way that I write, but my capacity to think about the things that I write, the sort of bigness, you know, an imaginative vision, you know, that's there. And then in sort of the second category, there's just, you know, there's sort of an accumulation of different communicators, not just writers, but preachers and preachers whose sermons can be read. And so I think of folks like Jonathan Edwards and Charles Spurgeon, who have really helped me kind of think through how to communicate theological ideas in an artful way, in an exaltational way. It's something I try to do with my writing, is not just get communication out, but sort of enjoy, you know, have a quality of joy in my communication, write in a way that sort of exalts in what I'm writing about, that's somewhat playful and has a, you know, flavor of glory to it, I guess. I like a lot of literary novelists, Michael Chabon, John Updike, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Philip Roth, just to kind of mix classic and modern. I like a lot of fiction. It helps stretch my capacity to even write nonfiction because it helps with creative writing. It helps with expression. Poetry is great. So there's just like a lot of little streams that kind of converge into one big river for me and have kind of helped me think through the way that I try to put words together into sentences.
How do other writers kind of follow what you're saying in terms of exulting and taking joy in, you know, their craft and writing well to the, you know, the glory of God? How do they do that?
Yeah, you know, I think you have to read, and you have to read widely. So I think one common mistake, especially preachers make, but folks who are trying to write for publication or what have you, you have to know the field that you're writing for. You need to, you know, familiarity there so you kind of know your way around the room. But you also need to read outside of that because it stretches different muscles in the brain. And that's why I would recommend preachers read fiction and poetry because it can't help but shape the way that they, you know, write their sermons. Not that you're telling a whole bunch of stories, but just that the way that you communicate the truths of Scripture, you're doing so in an artful way, in creative ways, in ways that sort of adorn the gospel with artfulness. And certainly I think that's true of writers as well. It's not that you need to become an expert in fields outside of your own, but you should dabble and read different genres and different authors. And it just sort of over time, you're flexing these different muscles. And so it just makes you a more versatile writer. I think if I could recommend one book, one modern book sort of on the subject, it's in John Piper's biography series. And he wrote a book called Seeing Beauty and Saying Beautifully, I think is what it's called. He talked about Lewis. He talks about George Herbert. It's three basically Christian writers, and he talks about how they didn't just sort of see the glory of Christ, but they were able to write about the glory of Christ in ways that convey a sense of that glory as well. They're saying the beauty that they see beautifully. So I'd recommend that just as a way to kind of look historically and see some examples, real working examples, excerpts from, you know, the works of these folks that really kind of help shape, if you're a writer, a preacher, whatever it is, that really kind of help shape you think in ways that sort of, you know, trail along with the glory of Christ.
So I know you work at Midwestern there, and say a student comes into your office and expresses a desire to be, you know, in ministry. Talk to that person like they're, you know, sitting right across from you.
Yeah, you know, what I would say is, first of all, is there a confirmation of this or affirmation of this from a community of faith? I think it's becoming increasingly common for young folks today to sense their calling or have an inspiration to some kind of ministry through their consumption of public ministry of others. So somebody wants to be a preacher because they love the preaching of John Piper or Mark Driscoll or whatever it is. And that's, the Lord can use that. I certainly wouldn't discount that at all. But I fear that we're losing sort of communal context, the idea that ministry is really to the local church and should come out of the local church. And so one of the first questions I ask somebody who, you know, emails me for advice a lot of times is to say, what does your pastor say? Because, you know, first of all, I don't want to undercut or undermine somebody's own local shepherding unless what they're saying is heretical or just really, really harmful. But that's pretty rare. You know, I ask that question, first of all, because that's the first person that somebody ought to go to for this kind of counsel. It shouldn't be to somebody that they know only through the internet or you know, somebody whose books that they read. That's fine to, you know, to write those people, to write people like me for advice and that kind of thing. But really, a sense of calling to ministry and a training for ministry needs to have the sort of local sourcing there. And so if someone says, hey, I believe that God is calling me into ministry, the first thing I want to know is, who else thinks that? Does your pastor think that? Does your Sunday school teacher think that? Does your community group leader think that? The other elders, the leaders in your church, are they affirming this call as well? Are they exploring this call with you as well? Because if you're going about it in really this kind of solo, you know, lone ranger kind of way, it's not going to be sustainable. And it's not actually training someone to have a heart for that local church if their calling was not sourced in the local church.
Very good answer. Why should Christians read fiction?
Well, like I said before, I think it, you know, reading fiction sort of stretches different muscles and it increases sort of the mental capacity to, you know, take in the glory of Christ. You know, the heavens declare the glory of God, as the Psalms say. And so that means that there are glimpses of Christ's glory to be found in all of creation. And fiction is well suited, good fiction is well suited to help us see beauty in places where we wouldn't, you know, see it in other avenues. I'd say the same is true for poetry. I'd say the same is true for taking in works of art, going to an art museum or what have you, even watching good films, all that sort of thing. You know, you have to be discerning with a lot of that stuff, you know, to sort of take every thought captive, to reject what's not, you know, beautiful, or to be able to identify what's not beautiful. Reading fiction, I think, sort of creates new grooves in the brain. And even if it's sort of, you know, well written, if it's, you know, has a sense of glory to it, can even sort of increase our heart, enlarge our heart for the things of God. Even if it's not an, you know, explicitly Christian work or explicitly religious work, it just helps us appreciate the world more, helps us appreciate the truth more. And if you're a communicator, a writer, a preacher, or so forth, it just helps you express in more creative ways, ways that adorn the gospel and give God more glory.
Which fiction books do you recommend that people start with?
Well, certainly we'll start with Lewis. A lot of the classics work this way. So, you know, things like Milton, some of the ancient myths, you know, certainly they're not historically true. Certainly they're not religiously true. The ancient myths, you know, carry with them these sort of broken shards of glory there. So, things like Virgil, Homer, you know, even more modern than, well, not modern in this sense, but more modern or more historically recent than the ancient myths, things like Dante, John Milton, Paradise Lost, and so on and so forth. In more modern times, I like the writing of Faulkner. I know he's, you know, it takes a certain taste to appreciate Faulkner, but the way that he writes, to some extent, F. Scott Fitzgerald as well, the way that they write has this sort of exaltational feel, sort of ecstatic feeling to it, so that their descriptions, some people would say that they're too verbose or purple prose or what have you, but it's just very well thought out. Read things like Hugo's Les Miserables, read some Nathaniel Hawthorne even. You know, some of the way that these guys write, it's just not common. I think if you read fiction, you need to get outside of like genre fiction. It's fine to read those things, crime thrillers and medical thrillers and legal thrillers and horror novels or what have you. But to get outside of that, read books that actually have something important to say.
Do you have any final thoughts you want to share about your book on Parallel?
Yeah, you know, briefly what I'd say is I hope the book could be well suited for both Christians who are trying to figure out, you know, how does the truth of Christianity speak to the growing problem that we have of irreligiosity? The objections to Christianity are becoming more emotional and less intellectual, although it's really a combination of the two. And so I hope that Christians will find the book helpful on that level to see how Christianity makes emotional sense as well as intellectual sense. And I think it's a book you could put in the hand of skeptics or unbelievers, certainly seekers, someone who's sincerely interested. Why is Christianity different? How is Christianity not just like every other religion or just one facet to the same truth or just one of many roads that leads to the same place? Unparalleled, I think, is the sort of book you hand to that person that demonstrates to them on so many different levels Christianity is utterly unique. It's not like any other religion or philosophy in the world.
Well, Jared, I want to thank you for your excellent answers and also for the writing that you do. I always enjoy reading it, and I know I'm not the only one. So thank you for writing well, for your thoughtful answers here in this interview.
Dave, thanks so much for having me. It was a blast.